Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Tobias Wolff, whose latest novel, his first novel actually, is called Old School. Tobias Wolff is also the author of two memoirs, In Pharaoh's Army and This Boy's Life, several collections of short stories, most recent collection of short stories, The Night in Question. You're primarily known as a short story writer, and in reading a book like Old School, I get the sense that it's a very long and complicated short story in that every word is in its proper place. And you don't find that in novels. It doesn't seem to be the kind of drift that most novels have.
Good. I'm glad to hear you say that. My model for novels doesn't tend to be the kind of Galsworthy sprawling novel. The ones I love are novels like Heart of Darkness. Conrad once said that a work of literary art must carry its justification in every line, and that's a very high standard to set, but that's the standard I like to work by. Whether or not I always succeed is another question, but that is what I like to do. It's a couple of hundred pages long, this novel. I do tend to gravitate in my reading towards short novels. I love William Kennedy's Billy Phelan's Greatest Game. I think it's my favorite of his novels, actually, which is 150 pages or so. William Maxwell's great novel, So Long, See You Tomorrow, comes in at about 120 pages. Camus' The Stranger, which I just lectured on this morning at Stanford to my freshmen, my 200 freshmen, is only 120 pages. So I love what can be done with the novel form in economy, as well as working in the short story.
Which brings up the question about the relationship of stories, memoir, novel. Knowing your history, Old School is clearly a novel because you are not the main character. It's obvious his past isn't yours, his future isn't your future. However, we can also tell from having seen in books like This Boy's Life and, more importantly, In Pharaoh's Army, the actual autobiographical connection between Old School and those. When working on Old School, what prompted you to put it in that particular form?
It's a very good question. It is certainly true that the main character has much in common with myself at that age. There's no doubt about it, and I wouldn't attempt to dissemble that. There are a few differences that are important differences, though. One is that I wanted this narrator to be at the center of events in his school. That meant that he would have to be a senior at the time that Frost visits, which is also the time that he's about to read at Kennedy's inauguration. So I had to make the narrator a couple of years older than I am. That was the first step. The novel revolves around these writing competitions in this boys' school. Boys compete for private audiences with visiting writers who come through, three of them a year. In fact, Ayn Rand never actually visited my school, nor did Ernest Hemingway. But these, together with Robert Frost, were the kind of iconic literary figures of my youth. And I wanted to bring them all together in this story, and a memoir wouldn't allow me to do that. It would have been a lying kind of memoir if I had done that, so why not call it a novel? And so, yes, I helped myself liberally to doses of my own past and my own memories in writing this, as novelists have always done. I mean, look at Sons and Lovers by Lawrence, or I could go on forever. I think even Lolita. Humbert Hubbard has a lot of Nabokov in him. But there is a critical mass of invention in this book that I really needed to do to get what I wanted to do in the book, so that it had to be a novel. A memoir wouldn't have allowed me to do what I did in this project.
You talk about the critical mass, and when you're talking about the difference between a novel based on memoir and a memoir, say, of events 30 years ago, or even a narrative like In Cold Blood, where is that line, that critical mass line between fiction and nonfiction?
Writers impose themselves on their material. If you turn your experience, your past, into a story, you have already given it a form that, in fact, at the time, it didn't have. Experience is undifferentiated. It washes over us. The extent to which we ever report our past as narrative is already highly edited, highly personalized thing. And it will always, you sit around the table at Thanksgiving with 20 people from your family, you start talking about something that happened 10 years ago, and everybody thinks everyone else has a bad memory. right? Everybody has a different... We remember things differently.
It's Rashomon, yeah.
Oh, that's right. Exactly. Rashomon, the point of view. Absolutely. But nevertheless, I think the crucial difference lies in intention. I meant to invent in this book. Therefore, it is fiction. When I report the past in the form of a memoir, I am reporting from my memory that which I remember occurring. And you have to remember, too, that in both this boy's life and in Pharaoh's army, with a few unfortunate exceptions, almost everybody that I went through these experiences with was still alive. So I had a discipline there. I had eyes reading these things over my shoulder. Most people are sophisticated enough to know that they will differ with me on questions of interpretation, what someone was like, that kind of thing. But on what happened, no. There's a check there. I mean, you can't say something happened where that didn't happen. Then why not call it a novel? Writing fiction allows you more liberties in the formation of your material. In fact, one is expected to find an appropriate form for the story you're telling. I think there's a difference between fiction and nonfiction, but there's no question at all that there's a lot of traffic between the imagination and memory, generally, and certainly there is in my work.
You've been asked the question why we care about the difference. What is it? Why do people want to know that it's true? You pondered it at the time, and the answer was kind of vague because it's something I don't think we can ever really know, or can we?
We do like to believe that things are true. I think that's one of the reasons we like movies so much. They give us the illusion of seeing something real happening in front of us, and that's why people get so exercised over a movie like JFK, because they think, well, this is, you know, people think this is real because, you know, it's on the screen, the images are happening in front of us, and there is that appetite that we have for appropriating fictional things and making them real in our own minds as if they happened.
What about the idea that sometimes fiction could be truer than reality?
I don't think that anything can be truer than reality. I do think there's a way in which when writers are writing autobiographically, they can become so nervous about exposing themselves, they can become so self-protective, that in the very act of trying to tell the truth about their past, they begin to obscure it and to obscure their part in it. I think, for example, Lillian Hellman's memoirs are a very excellent example of that, the way she glamorizes herself, valorizes herself constantly. She's always the one with the clever thing to say. She always is the courageous one when everyone else is cringing with their tail between their legs. When I read that in a memoir, I tend to distrust it. And yet in her plays, in her fiction, there's tremendous truth. In Little Foxes, it's a fantastic, powerful play. And there she could drop the mask because the mask of fiction is already there. She could write with ease in a truthful way. And in that odd, paradoxical way, I do see that some writers work more truthfully in fiction than they would in autobiography.
So how do you take it when the Washington Post says, as they did, that your memoirs avoid the emotional immediacy of your short stories?
Well, I don't know what to say. I don't think it's true. She obviously didn't care for the memoirs and was trying to find some reason to give for not liking them. She did like the stories and so was using a point of contrast between them that I didn't think was valid, but that's what reviewers get to do.
Tobias Wolff, let's talk about some of the content of these books. In Old School, there are these crucial events, some of which are fiction, some are not. So let me throw some of this out to you. Let's find out what really is real and what isn't. Now, you said that Robert Frost came to your school, but it was before you were there.
No, it was I was there.
Oh, you were
I was
there.
Young. I was
you
younger
young.
Than my narrator.
Were you there?
Yeah,
at
I was
the event?
There.
Is this the event that happened?
Not exactly the way I report it, no. There's a great deal of invention about that. I didn't hear a word he said, for one thing. I was sitting in the back because I was young. He mumbled a little that night, and it was very unclear. And I liked the idea of going back as a writer and making things happen the way they should have happened. And so in my novel, it's rather different.
The idea that the winner of a contest gets to spend time alone with the author, is that also Tobias Wolff's fiction?
You know, I can't even remember anymore whether it is or not. For years, I mean, we did have these literary competitions, and now and then boys would meet alone with the writers. For the life of me, I can't say with any great confidence whether that was a result of these competitions or whether that was something entirely other, just a favorite of the teacher. But I think that it did have something to do with these writing competitions.
The events, I assume, are all fictional, and the people are fictional.
Yeah, they are fictions. These people. Now, obviously, I couldn't have written about them in the way I do had I not known people in some ways like them. But they are not directly transplanted from life.
The ending of the book, without giving anything away, is about moral choices,
mm-hmm.
making a moral choice,
mm-hmm.
and it struck me that there is a distinct parallel between our narrator's moral choice, or rather his not thinking about the moral choice and dealing with the consequences. The same could be said of the headmaster. The same could also be said of Tobias Wolff and a certain helicopter incident in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. However, I would make this difference between the two things. In making the catastrophic mistake that he makes in Old School, the narrator actually thinks he's doing something good. He is so self-deceived at that point that he actually is in the grip of a desire to tell the truth about himself, and that's what leads him to make a terrible mistake. There was real malice in me when I allowed another officer in Vietnam to bring a helicopter down too close to a bunch of huts, kind of temporary huts, and to blow them, really a lot of them, down and make a mess of things. He wanted to do it. He rather insisted on doing it. But if I had really, really insisted myself, though I did not have his rank, I probably could have dissuaded him, or if I had talked to the helicopter pilot. But I wanted him to make a mistake and to do something really stupid, because I disliked him so much, and I ended up hurting other people in a way that I still remember and regret. That impulse of anger and revenge that led me to do that is, I think, very different from what drives the boy in the novel. But, Kierkegaard said at one point, every moment is a choice between life and death. That's a pretty austere program, but the truth is, We create ourselves every day by the choices we make of this kind. And, you know, we sculpt our characters every moment in that way.
Do you find yourself now, 30-odd years later, basing moral choices sometimes upon the path you took then and choosing not to take that path again?
Yes, we school our instincts over the years. And you feel a kind of red flag coming up at certain moments in your life when you feel yourself bending towards something that you probably shouldn't bend toward. You've been there before. You know what it's like to do it and what it's like to feel like afterwards. And, you know, if you're not addicted, maybe you can help yourself.
You're listening to an interview with Tobias Wolff, whose novel is Old School. There are three authors who were engaged to come to this school. Robert Frost, we've discussed. Ernest Hemingway, a favorite of yours. We won't tell what happens, what the conclusion of that is, but it's understandable given your own interest in Hemingway. The third, though, Ayn Rand, who does make an appearance, you said at one point that they were chosen because they created outsized public images of themselves. However, that still doesn't get down to why the Rand choice? I mean, I understand the other two, but why Ayn Rand?
Why Ayn Rand? It had to do with her influence. She was, in many ways, of the three, the most influential over young minds. She had a social vision in a way that Hemingway, for example, did not. Hemingway had ways of behaving that he taught young men, of talking, things to do that were cool. Ayn Rand taught young people how to think. She taught them how to think badly, as I now understand, but she taught them how to think. She demanded a certain kind of response from her readers, very, very seductive, very powerful, partly because it was very simple. It let you off the hook in terms of having any kind of social conscience. You were not your brother's keeper. Your brother was his own keeper, and you were your keeper. We, some years ago, delighted in being told that we had an inner child. Well, I mean, you can imagine what it was like to be told that you had an inner giant, which was what she was telling you. You know, you have a giant slumbering inside of you. These were immensely powerful ideas for young people, and in fact, they still have an influence on our country now. The Libertarian Party of this country comes right out of Ayn Rand's objectivist movement. And indeed, a lot of her ideas have spilled from the Libertarian Party into the Republican Party of this country. So this, you know, as Faulkner said once, the past isn't dead, it isn't even past. Well, Ayn Rand isn't even past. She still has an influence on the way people think about things. My own undergraduates at Stanford read her. You ask booksellers how her books do. Her books do not stay in the bookstores. They are still popular. They are still read, The Fountainhead especially. And I fell under her sway for about a year. My narrator gets over it faster. I don't have time in this novel to give it its due. And it didn't do anything for my character, I can tell you.
I was talking about a year and a half ago to someone who had moved out from Washington, he'd been working with several other people in the Washington milieu, late Clinton, early Bush years, and there's an undercurrent of Ayn Rand among all of them. That's what they talked about,
oh,
and it scared the hell out of me. Scared the hell out
it
of
should.
Me.
It should. She's interesting, though. I have to say, you know, she was kind of a monster personally. When I read the biographies of her, they just made my jaw drop. She was amazing. But one thing I really liked about her is, boy, she was serious about her ideas. I read the letters of all these writers because I wanted to catch their habits of thought and the way their minds turned. One thing I really liked about Ayn Rand is that if anybody, no matter how old they were, and I'm talking about 12 and 13-year-olds, wrote her a letter on some intellectual point in a book of hers, she would write back a 2 or 3 page single-spaced letter to them. People could do her no good at all and would really take up her time. She was that serious about getting her ideas into the world. She thought the world needed those ideas. And she was in that way extremely democratic. She dealt with 13-year-olds as if they were her equals, and she could also be ferocious to them in that way, too. She was really mean to people when she would go out and give lectures. If somebody raised a question from the audience, which in any way betrayed that they hadn't read all of her work, they'd have their heads taken off in some unforgettable way. But I loved reading about her. She's, God, I mean, she really was sui generis. I've never encountered anyone like her. It's a complicated thing, really. I mean, here's a woman who grew up in the aftermath of the Russian Revolution. Her professors at Leningrad University were being taken out and shot daily. Friends of hers were shot. The collectivization that went on then. We all know what happened in Ukraine, and we know now that St. Vladimir started slaughtering people pretty much as soon as he took over. It wasn't just Stalin. And she saw that, and she developed a very understandable hatred of collectivization and the rhetoric of collectivization. She saw the left's flirtation with that when she came over here, that naive and dangerous hypnotic effect that that ideology had on people in this country. And she wanted to scare them out of it. But it led her to a kind of extreme of statement and vision that in itself then became another kind of danger.
How do you think Ayn Rand would have felt if she were still alive and read a book like In Pharaoh's Army?
Oh, she would fault me in every case. First of all, because one of the things that In Pharaoh's Army is about the way an ordinary person, which is what I pretty much was, can get picked up by history and carried into events and situations in which he will discover things about himself that he really wished he didn't know. And I'm sure that a lot of our people in Iraq are undergoing that right now. She would have no sympathy for someone in that situation. At any moment, she would have said, you need to declare yourself and to take a stand. And if this isn't what you yourself want to do in your own interest and for your own pleasure and happiness, then you resist it and you declare yourself and get out of that situation. She didn't believe that there was anything noble about dying in a war, even for a supposedly good cause, if you didn't really want to. I mean, she had very radical ideas of this kind. So, no, she would have found me a pusillanimous drifter with no as she would put it, premises.
Tobias Wolff, you have said about that period that writers were our rock stars.
They were for the boys that I went to school with, more than any other group of people that I can think of. And I thought for years about why that might be so. I think it had a lot to do with class. I think that literature offered us a way of transcending these pressures of class that were particularly pronounced at a school like that. I went to a place called the Hill School, which is actually, I've moved the school even in the book. But certainly I drew very heavily on the atmosphere and rituals and sense of class and privilege and entitlement that was very much a part of life there and was very befuddling to me, a scholarship boy from the West who really was blind to a lot of that when I first arrived and became hypersensitive to it as time went on. It was the memory of all that and wondering, you know, what did draw me so strongly to reading and writing, especially the idea of being a writer and so many other boys as well. And I think it had a lot to do with this business of class, of somehow writers forming a class of their own and being a writer gave you an identity, and not only an identity, but a cool identity. And so you subtracted yourself in that way from this Darwinian business that was going on in the rest of the school. Or in the rest of life, as you supposed when you left it. I think that had a lot to do with it.
Let's talk for a minute, if I can, about short fiction, because that seems to be what draws you the most. When you are creating short fiction, how are you going about doing it? Do you have structure beforehand? Do you have story, or do you just have a first sentence?
Every story begins differently for me. Sometimes I'll actually have a pretty clear idea of everything that's going to happen, and then that will change as I write it. But I will have almost a kind of outline in my mind of the story. Other times I'll begin a story with no more than a vague sense. Chekhov once said, all you need to write a story is he, she, and an ashtray. And sometimes I'll begin with he, she, and an ashtray, but there's something there that I want to get at that's gnawing at me that I'll work at, a conversation or something. And that will give birth to a story that I hadn't envisioned fully when I began it, but as I write, begins to give itself to me. And then I rewrite it and rewrite it. Obviously, by the time I do the last draft of a story, I know exactly what is going to happen. Doing the first drafts of a story, I really keep myself open to surprises. I like to be surprised by the material, and I like the feeling of giving up my original intention for something better that presents itself that I hadn't anticipated. That's very important to me when I write. If I don't get that, it usually isn't very good. I love writing short stories. It's just such a beautiful form. Somebody once said of the novel, when asked to describe the novel form, they said, well, it's a prose narrative of a certain length that has something wrong with it. But you could say of the best short stories that they are prose narratives of a certain length that have nothing wrong with them. There's a kind of perfection you can achieve in the short story form. And for fussy people like me, control freaks, it's a form that you can really manage or gives you the illusion that you can manage it because of its length. Of course, it's a very difficult, very demanding form. And as you said at the beginning of this interview, the novel actually tends to offer people a little more elbow room and a little more drift. The short story holds your nose to it. You've got to make everything count in a short story. And I love the challenge of that. And I love the effect that a short story has, a good one. The best short stories I've read have stayed in my memory as if they were my own memories. They have that kind of power to attach themselves to you. I know the difference between a novel and a memory. Sometimes I don't know the difference between a short story I've read and a memory. There's a story of Cheevers, in which it's maybe 4 pages long, in which the narrator's a boy, and he meets his father for lunch a couple of times. And every time he meets his father for lunch, it's a very funny story and very sad. His father insults the waiters until they get thrown out of the restaurant. It happens like 2 or 3 times. And obviously, the pain that the father is undergoing from this estrangement with his son is what's going on in the story that the son can't see, and it's just so beautifully done. It's funny and it's hard. And I feel like that's my story when I read it, you know?
Tobias Wolff, can writing be taught?
I don't think so, no. What you can do is create, for a time, a community of passionate readers. You can make writing matter to people. You can put it at the front of their lives for a while, and you can help young people to become good readers of their own work, good critics of their own work, and attentive critics of others. And at the end of that process, they actually become very, very good readers. Most people who take writing courses are not going to be writers. I mean, think of it. Actuarially, it's an infinitesimal number who will never be writers. But it's a wonderful way to learn what a writer does, how a book and a story come together, the difficulties and challenges of that. So when you read a really good one, you know what's happened, and you can really take your hat off. But it can also be an essential process for a young writer to become self-aware, to learn to read one's work better, to be acquainted by someone like me with other writers who have tried to do the same thing, and you say, okay, you should read this, you should read that. This book here is very important for you because you'll learn a lot to help you with what you're trying to do here that they wouldn't be able to get on their own. And all that can help someone become a writer. But can I put a chip in someone's head that'll make them a writer? No.
Tobias Wolff, this boy's life was turned into a film. What did you feel about that?
There were things about the film that puzzled me. I don't know why they would do this rather than do that. But on the whole, I liked the movie. I thought it was a pretty good movie. But I have to say that when I watched it, I was watching a movie. That was what I felt like. I was watching a movie. And then there would be something that would make me think, oh, that reminds me of something that happened to me, you know? I mean, and then there would be these jolts in it. But they didn't always come out of the book. That was the odd thing. They were more intuitional in nature. There's this scene that's shot from outside of this kind of this rundown house where everybody is for the holidays, and somebody's playing a tinkly piano and they're singing, "We were sailing along on Moonlight Bay, and this family has come together. They're going to try to make one family out of two, and it's not going to work. We already kind of know that, but they're trying." And suddenly you're outside of the house, and you're looking at this house with the window, the light coming out of the windows, and the voices coming out, and they're hopeful, and they're all in for a lot of trouble. And it just went to my heart, that scene. But it's not in my book. And it felt so true and so familiar. It just gave me such a soul shiver to see that. And a lot of the things that were best in the movie were things that weren't even in the book, I thought. It was the director operating out of an imaginative engagement with the material that transcended a kind of slavish treatment of it. And so I couldn't really, since I liked those things so much, I couldn't fault him for not being literal in other cases.
Was there any time where he was literal but wrong?
No, I mean, there were some very arbitrary changes they made that I didn't quite understand, and I never could figure out. They fool around with the point of view a bit in the movie. Two scenes in particular are shown us without the boy having any knowledge of them or being present. And yet the film is represented, as the book is, as a record of what the boy has seen and experienced. There's even a voiceover to reinforce that. I can never get my head around why they did that. And I mean, those were, of course, the two sex scenes in the movie. It wasn't that they were cheap. I don't think it was like going for it. They thought that they needed to do that to characterize the mother further and to show her situation better. But they, you know, as a writer, it just seemed such a violation of the procedures of point of view to me that I could never quite get over it. But it wasn't a problem for them. And it, you know what? It hasn't been a problem. Once in a while, someone will come up to me who actually hasn't read the book and say, I mean, how could you know what your mother's sex life was like? And I say, read the book. I don't know. I'm glad I don't know.
Tobias Wolff, you've said that you won't write any more memoir. Do you still feel that way? You said that right after writing In Pharaoh's Army.
Yeah, well, as people have reminded me, I also said it right after writing This Boy's Life. So I guess I better pull my horns in on all these vows of never doing this and never doing that. I suppose it's possible that I might write a record someday of the writing life, for example. But I don't have any plans to. I have fiction in mind now.
You've been listening to an interview with Tobias Wolff, whose novel, his first novel, is Old School. Other books include the short story collection, The Night in Question, and memoirs This Boy's Life and In Pharaoh's Army. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.